Hello and welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly.
I'm Mike Philbrick.
And this is Raise Your Average. Markets are whipsawing on ceasefire headlines. Oil is at $100 a barrel. Gold sold off when it was supposed to rally. And cash is now outranking U.S. equities in the asset class rankings. This is the market advisors have been navigating over the last couple of months. And the advisors who are holding up, they're not reacting faster. They may simply be working from a better framework. Paul Kornfeld, our guest today, is portfolio manager and director of technology services at SIA Wealth Management. SIA runs a rules-based relative strength approach that's been flagging these rotations in real time before most advisors knew what hit them. And he's got a lot to say about where the model is pointing right now.
This is Raise Your Average, dedicated to making you a better long-term investor. Join us as we sit down with some of the most interesting names in finance to discuss macro, markets, investment strategies, and more.
Paul, welcome. It's great to have you back. It's great to have you on the show today.
Thanks so much, Pierre.
First of all, Paul, how you been?
I think this is my fourth time on the podcast. So
yeah,
I think the last time we talked about buy the dip or sell the rip.
That's right.
And so I kind of look at it this time of, you know, is this a real rotation or is this just a relief rally? Like what kind of situation are we in today, right? There always seems to be kind of this turning point every time we have our conversations, Pierre and Mike. So looking forward to getting into it.
Maybe like when you're talking to advisors, like you're talking to, you know, advisors who are using your platform, but you're probably also talking to a lot of advisors who aren't. And what do you see or flag as some of the differences?
Obviously there's lots at stake. I think this is one of the, or there's lots of times I'm very thankful that I have the SI Charts kind of financial technology to help me guide through the system, have a disciplined approach. I don't know what I would do without it because, you know, I think what most advisors are trying to do and what they're getting from their clients is a lot of, hey, what's going to happen? Like, you know, trying to predict the markets. And that's you know, there's enough predictions out there on the internet to even week by week, day by day, that's a losing environment, right? So what we try to help advisors with is just simply to align with the market. Where is the system taking you? Is it taking you into energy, into oil right now? Or is it taking you into the NASDAQ that's had, I think, 10 days of positive returns at the time of this recording? Is that a real relief rally? Is that something bigger? The S&P again hitting near all-time highs. Like, is that something that we can count on here going forward, or is there better opportunities in Canada or internationally? So I think, yeah, working with advisors, working with institutions, our approach at SI Wealth is really just, hey, let's make sure we're aligning with the market and making, not making those kind of big calls. We just want to make sure we identify those trends when they change, when those rotations happen. As you kind of pointed out, there's a lot of that going on this year and last year. For sure, this time about a year ago, we were talking about tariffs and tariff deals and trade wars. And now we're talking about, hey, is there probably the worst quarter for travel here coming forward with energy prices as high since COVID pandemic, right? There's a lot of factors at play and looking forward to getting into it with you.
I wonder if we might start from the perspective of just a little background. So not everybody will have heard the other four podcasts and may not actually know what and how rolls through the waterfall of determining, you know, first, is market friendly or not friendly? Second, what parts of market might be friendly? And that extends both to sectors, international equity exposures, commodities, bonds, currencies. There's a lot of choice for investors and advisors for their clients. And a framework certainly is a good one, and yours is exceptional, I think, because it pays attention to price, and price is what manifests on a statement at the end of the month. And so being attentive to when risk is high and taking action and, you know, not letting the maniacs run the asylum per se in your portfolio makes some sense. But I wonder if you have a 60-second sort of, summary of the approach so that people who can follow along who may not be familiar.
For sure. And then, you know me, I got slides that we can get into.
Excellent. I love the slides.
If we want some of the visual
to talk about.
Exactly.
Hey, listen, I love it. A war and absolute anarchy, massive peak pessimism on headlines. And what do we have? We have a roaring rally. Now, is it a short covering rally? Well, they are all are at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And when I hearken back and look at the other examples in the market of what has behaved like this in the past, where have we had a rip and a gap up? And then more returns. Well, it's kind of a lot like October of 2002. And you know who we were having a war with then? Iraq.
Hmm.
And the market bottomed on the invasion day and then subsequently ripped somewhat like we have today. So, and that was a little bit more, you know, that's an interesting one. The challenge there is obviously that was after a monstrous bear market. So, not the same, but again, it just serves as headlines are headlines, but price action is more important. And so
what's that saying? Buy on mystery, sell on history.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Well, I think, and a lot of those signals are manifesting today. So back to you, Paul, you know, let's give some people a little bit of insight into the tools and then let's roll into what you're seeing today.
Sure. So yeah, just a quick overview of what SIA is all about. Like you said, we're a disciplined shop, all system based. And what we really focus on is I like to simplify it into opportunity cost, right? Where is the money flowing? And we're able to track that money flow through relative strength analysis. And by comparing each asset class to each other, each sector to each other, each individual position, each ETF to each other. And by doing that, millions and millions of times, we use point and figure analysis behind the scenes to do those one-on-one comparisons. So it's like doing a whole bunch of boxing matches and determining the winner. And that's going to help us identify, hey, do we want to be in computer software right now? Is it undervalued? Or do we want to be in computer hardware, electronics and semiconductors? Like, that's a pretty simple, easy one right now. But it's those kind of major decisions and turning points we're able to see in those inflection points. Do we want to be in energy or in gold right now? Or do we want to be in Canada versus the US, right? We can do that from that top-down approach. So really to simplify it, what we're trying to do is never to predict the market. That's not our goal. We're trying to identify the major trends in the market using relative strength and aligning with the market so that we can measure the opportunity cost. And sometimes that opportunity cost is saying, hey, we might need to go to cash. We might need to be protective right now because this is a 2008 scenario or a 2020 scenario or, like you said, maybe a 2000 scenario at the bottom or that turning point before the war. So, that's kind of a quick summary of what SIA is all about. And then what we can do here is I got some slides that we can break that down and even show the trend over the last year, whenever you guys are ready.
And let me just add a little bit of clarification. So when Paul is talking about relative strength, and then he goes through like the NCAA bracket of each thing playing off against one another. Who's doing best? What's happening? So what he means is that relative to, when he said this stock relative to that one, that's where the term relative strength comes from. So you're looking at things from an opportunity cost perspective relative to one another. Should I be in this that's doing well or this that's doing poorly? And the reason that that tends to work is because of that momentum and trend factor in the market. Things that are going in a certain direction tend to continue to go in that direction. So that is the house edge that you have when you're looking at those stronger sectors, stronger stocks, stronger asset classes. And that's that relative strength. So that's what Paul's talking about when he's digging into a little bit under the surface for those who may be a little bit less initiated on this. So there's lots of research out there. Momentum is a thing. Trend is a thing. They tend to continue to go up or go down. And that's what you're harnessing by making sure you're focusing in those areas, focusing on the winning side of the NCAA bracket in the asset class world. Well,
yeah. And speaking of you know, vectors and core strategic long-term investment plans. I'm sure I put money on it that advisors, you know, want to know and investors too want to know, you know, is their core thesis still in place? You know, is the rotation still something to point for, like the rotation from, let's say, growth to value or domestic to international? the thesis. Yeah. I mean, are those things still in place, or has this, you know, conflict thrown everything out the window? I think gold, you know, provided sort of a conflicting signal here, in the last month and a half. And then if you know, so I think that's part of it, but I'm also interested in knowing, like, you know, as of, let's say, December, January, what were the signals that you were getting, Paul, at your end, in terms of how, not only how that rotation was unfolding and manifesting itself, but also, you know, what were the early signals you were getting from energy, for example, which has been really strong. And, you know, for those who, obviously nobody foresaw, you know, the war, but as we got closer and closer to it, things were building. There was this negotiation and, you know, so-called negotiation, whatever it was, a red herring. Anyway, Paul, we'll.
Yeah. And I love the charts, Paul. I think the anatomy of something that might be interesting for us to delve into, and instructive, would be the anatomy of the gold bull that happened over the last couple of years.
Sure.
You know, going through that as a lesson for folks so they could see actually what's happening. So gold and silver have become very popular. They're entering the lexicon. But it's different at 2000, where we got good signals, versus 4000 and the opportunity and being there early. There's a benefit to that. So anyway, go through the charts you've got prepared now. And I'll put you on the spot for maybe a little bit of anatomy. Of a bull market and outperformance by gold versus other asset classes, and when those signaled for you to start making allocations.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was one of the main ones I was getting ready to prepare and for this call. Love so, it. We can definitely get into that. So I wanted to talk.
And another key here, I think, to highlight is that, you know, this isn't about making, knee-jerk reaction calls, right? I don't want advisors or, you know, our audience to look at this and think, you know, does this thing tell me what to do on a daily basis? Or it's not a day trading system. It's, you know, it's something about making long-term strategic calls as well, because your relative strength indicators are forward-looking. They're not hindsight-looking. They're not day-to-day looking. And so I think that's an important factor to consider as well when we're
definitely charts. Tactical and active, but we're not a buy and hold shop. We're not a day trading system. Like you said, we are trying to identify those macro trends. And I think this chart kind of put that into perspective a little bit, just from a top down level. So this is talking about risk management. If you're just listening to the podcast, we're looking at the equity action call. And what we're looking at is kind of three different levels. Very simply, if you're at a stoplight, are you risk on? Are you risk off? Are you putting your foot on that gas pedal and staying in the market? So throughout this whole time period, this uncertainty with the Iran conflict, the run up with energy, all this to start the year, the markets have been positive for the most part, especially on the Canadian international side. And that's kind of where we've been pointing, which I'll show you in the next slide. So this is just kind of to help us understand, you know, overall, looking back over the last 20, 25 years here, about 70% of the time, we're staying in the market. And like you said, Pierre, we're keeping aligned with the market to participate to that upside. But how do things look today, right? Like, where are things at? Well, we actually have seen cash move up quite a bit over the last little while, actually even above US equity. And so that's definitely a different kind of take than most people probably were expecting. We have seen commodities start to move down. Now, we look at commodities a little bit different than most people. We're equal weighting. We're, you know, giving maybe some lesser known commodities, like maybe a larger share than, you know, the ETFs out there might, but it still is an accurate statement to say, like, hey, overall, energy is doing really well. But like you said, precious metals and mining, they've come off, right? Gold's down from 55, 85 high down to 4,800 or wherever it is trading around today. right? We've seen those kind of things come back a little bit, but we've seen money flow continually go to kind of places outside of the US, especially in Canada. I think we'll talk a little bit more about that as well. We're also seeing fixed income literally being, nobody's talking about it, but it's being stapled to the bottom for various reasons. We don't have to get into them all today. But, you know, just those kind of calls is why we're still in it, in a kind of a positive equity market. And if we kind of look back, I wanted to, you know, also look back over the last year, what has this actually been looking like? Well, we talked about commodities, and precious metals has been basically our number one sector all of 2025. And it helped drive up the commodity asset class throughout 2025 as well. But we really saw a major shift last April, really, where international overtook US. So this isn't a new story we've been telling. This is the story I've been telling advisors and different, anybody that'll listen to me over the last year, for sure, if not a little bit longer. But that's April last year is when I remember kind of going on record around that, where international overtook US. And that to us is a significant move, because US has been so strong for a decade, from 2012, 2013 to 2022. Is pretty much number one asset class. And my story to advisors, most of that whole decade has been, hey, overweight US over Canada. That's how you found that outperformance. And now my story's changed. I still believe in US equity. There's so many great places to be, so many great sectors, so many great companies. But from an index, a macro standpoint, things are changing. And that's what we want to align with the market. I don't have to know exactly all the main reasons, or you don't either. It's just, hey, this is what the market is telling us. They're saying to bet on Canadian equity. Look at that. It's been number one or two pretty much that whole time period over last year. And it's had a phenomenal year last year, up, what, 33% or something around that in 2025, and off to a good start so far, obviously on the back of energy. So if you're not also doing the next level that we'll look into, as well, that kind of shift to what sectors, what opportunities are out there. We can see this is since the beginning of 2025. You can see that shift, and kind of highlighting it here in April, like this wasn't necessarily known that this next part was going to happen, right? Like I said, we don't make predictions. We just say, hey, money flow.
Categorically not known.
Yeah, exactly. So you start seeing this shift in March, right? So this is the underperformance period, maybe, where we were overweight US equity versus international. But then it's the next year or 10 years, right? We're talking, usually these trends are decades long. These are not a small time frame. And of course, that could change, but it's already been a year of that trend happening and supporting both Canada and international over the US for various reasons. So, and the US is now in the middle of a conflict in the Middle East, right? Like, that's not necessarily helping the market, maybe in the short term, as we're seeing just in this April, but in March it didn't. So again, they're still down or close to down or about break even on the year. I'm not sure what they're up, but it's not a bull market. You just looked at that performance. So this is kind of that major macro difference. So we, again, just start from a high level, like Mike was talking about earlier, just, hey, what's that opportunity cost? How do I want to best position myself? And if you just take one thing away from this conversation today, maybe it's reevaluating your US equity position versus international in Canada here going forward. Just maybe look at that coin and say, okay, maybe I want to overweight some of the European countries that are actually cooperating and getting together and not creating trade barriers against themselves. And as Canada looks for more trade partners and increases defense spending, and as gold and energy hit basically record highs, those are very positive for the Canadian markets, and especially the financial industry that's so strong within Canada.
I just, before you go on this away from this chart, Paul, I want to add one other thing, because it's a nuance that I think is applicable today. Which is, when you look at the beginning of that chart, and we're looking at the S&P TSX composite, we're looking at the S&P 500 composite, we're looking at the All World ACWI ETF, and you see All World and Canada performing significantly, and it started, the outperformance started from going lower from a drawdown perspective, from the standpoint of, the relative strength was stronger in the tariff tantrum for Canadian stocks and global stocks over US stocks. The US stocks went down more than these other ones did in the correction. And that's what you're looking for today. What went through this correction but had relative strength? Because that's the leadership that's going to come out of, if this is a viable longer-term rally, it's likely that you're going to see those things that pulled back less during this period do better. And so that's going to be your hint to start looking at your buy list and building your buy list. Something that I've observed for those in the digital currency market is that while we've been at war, while markets have been plunging to these lows, digital assets like Bitcoin and Ethereum have actually made higher lows. Very much like we're seeing here. It's one of those things. So those are the situations you want to be aware of at this time. You're having a correction. What's holding up better? Because that often will likely perform better as we get into the next bull market, if we do, right? Then you got to risk management. You got to look at this on a regular basis. The facts change and you might have to pivot a little bit. But as we sit now, those are the things that you want to start to think through.
For sure. I mean, it looks, you know, it looks like not only a market, you know, divergence between, Canada and the world versus the US. It looks like the same, it, you know, you could even say this was a chart of the ideological pull, you know, the ideological divergence that's taken place. You know, where Canada and the rest of the world is pulling away from the US, even politically, at least for the time being. But that also signals a dramatic shift in sentiment.
There'll always be reasons. But the reasons will manifest after the price makes you develop a story. So narrative comes after price in my experience. And so, you know, you have this war happening and you have the resolution. Look at the price action. We shot up past the 21 day, the 50 day, the 200 day, cleared all the moving averages. And all of a sudden it's like, that is strength. Yeah. Now it's always a short covering rally at the beginning. And so how does it go from here is very important. But yeah, back over to you, Paul.
Yeah. Thanks.
The other thing is I just wanted to add, because I think when you look at, you know, because we had this conversation with Meb Faber last week, which was about, you know, people turn around, and they say, oh, the easy money's being made. And I absolutely love that point, because, you know, people will look at this and say, oh, the easy money's being made. Are you sure it's the right time to get in? Is this fundamentally a long-term signal? But the key was, you know, like, were you shifting to Canada and international before this divergence took place? And I think that's the key signal that we would want to get into with you is, was your platform, was your framework signaling this fundamental shift or technical shift from US equities to Canada and international beforehand. So advisors on your platform would have received these signals beforehand, not now, obviously today. Looking back in hindsight, it's wonderful to see, you know, international and Canada doing well, but beforehand, would the signal have been there for investors, advisors to start to make that rotation then when it wasn't a popular idea?
Yeah, for sure. And that's why this story last really a year ago was a tough one, because I didn't have all the reasons why it was working yet. But that's what the system, the price action, as Mike talked about, was showing us. Hey, there's a shift away from the US into international. Canada kind of was part of that international at that time, where that money flow was going. And it was going into real assets, right? It was going to gold, silver, platinum. People were looking for different ways to taking the carry trade that's happening in Japan. And there's less money going into US dollars now, right? So they're going somewhere. And those are leaving the US, and it's not always the stock market. The stock market, like I said, there's still a lot of great companies, all those opportunities, but those kind of things are being measured and moving around. If we look internationally, where is that money flowing, right? Is it flowing to South America, right? Is anybody talking about South America? This is one of our favorite areas right now, because it's really not affected by the Middle Eastern conflict, right? All these Brazil, energy companies and South America. Like there's lots of opportunities there, and it doesn't seem to be too late for that. And what else is really strong? Well, we're seeing a lot of the tech companies that are more positioned for the semiconductors, the computer hardware side of things, like South Korea, doing very well as well. Also on here, right? So what's most affected? Well, we just talked about it. The US, Middle East, those are the names to watch. India, that gets a lot of its oil from Strait of Hormuz, Indonesia, same kind of things, right? So these are how things have moved over time and how we can be positioned. So even though we talk about international equity, there's this huge gap there, and relative strength is really helpful for identifying and comparing each of those countries against each other. So even though we talk about even Canada being one of the best places to be, well, just year to date, it's not actually the best place to be, right? Like there is other opportunities out there that we can look at. But when we're looking at our relative strength analysis, Canada is still a very strong place to be from that macro standpoint. And we are based out of Calgary in Canada, so we have that home bias where we're looking at our stock market and everything that way. And there's, again, still great opportunities there. So any kind of comments on this before I can kind of shift into maybe more of a sector industry? Because that was, I think, one of your main questions, Pierre, that I wanted to answer is, hey, let's actually look at the sector. Let's look at those movements and those differences that are happening now and happened before.
I think from a practical sense, what I would offer to the advisors out there and allocators is that when you see that relative strength outperformance from the bottom and the tariff tantrum, that's your opportunity to start to think through within your portfolio your strategic weights versus your dynamic weights. Hmm. And you saw that, and so you don't have to decide that day, I'm going to sell all my U.S. equities and buy all international.
Yeah.
It's not zero or one. What you would look at is you say, oh, my strategic weighting, I've been underweight Europe for several years, and now that's changing. And so maybe I'm going to move to a neutral weight position, and I'm going to see what happens. And then as the strength continues to confirm, I'm going to go maybe to overweight. And I'm going to keep an eye on the strength. I'm going to keep an eye vis-a-vis its moving averages. I'm going to want to see, you know, price above moving averages to some degree on an individual basis, maybe to look at some places where I might reduce my exposure again. But again, it's not zero or one, right? It's an incremental change. Think through your portfolio and the position.
Yeah.
See the change. And making smaller change is more achievable, right? I don't think a big bet is required. What's required is slow and steady monitoring and adaptation to reflect what's currently garnering strength in the markets.
It's kind of like the dials on an equalizer,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, where, you know, you start at zero and you're plus or minus.
Yeah. Think about it this way. We think about it as a light switch. Is it a dimmer or is it a switch? It's a dimmer. It's a dimmer, right? It's not a light. You don't have to be on off. It's not zero one. You mm-hmm. can actually have whatever lighting you'd like. You can have whatever exposure to these areas that you'd like.
Perfect. I think, you know, ultimately that's what an advisor is looking for in a framework is, you know, how do I make these nuanced adjustments to my portfolio? It's kind of like, you know, you've got all these dials and you want to turn some up sometimes and turn some down. And, you know, you've got to look at the signals and see, okay, you know, everything is relative, right? It's underweight, neutral, overweight. And to Mike's point, so it's not about, risk on and risk off per se, where you turn off all the risk in your portfolio. That's detrimental to any investment strategy.
In the right circumstances, it could be a lot of risk off, right? Again, if you have a structure you say, well, I'll actually, I'm comfortable being 50% cash for whatever reason. And I'm using these signals. Well, if cash relatively is outperforming all your asset classes, you're probably going to start to trim your asset classes and have more cash as you go through a correction to some low point where you're just not going to go any lower than that in your exposures. Anyway, the sectors. All right. Let's jump into those.
Yeah. And to your point, Mike, like a lot of advisors don't have that ability to go to cash, or they're not comfortable making those kind of calls. And that's honestly where they need a Resolve Asset Management. They need an SIA Wealth Management to help them make those strategic calls for them, where they can have kind of that tactical sleeve as part of their portfolio, whether that's 5%, 10%. Obviously, the higher weight, the more it's impacting it. We talk to advisors all the time about that 20% weighting. Like, hey, you don't have to be right or wrong. Let the, hopefully the experts, the, you know, the wealth management tactical firms that are making those kind of calls, or just shifting there, it makes it so much easier from an implementation standpoint, rather than them kind of saying and calling all their clients, right? It can be hidden within the funds that have that tactical ability to go, like our funds, from 100% equity to 100% cash. There's very few of zero in Canada that can kind of make those kind of calls and look like an equity fund and be positioned as a medium risk fund and all those kind of metrics, because that's exactly, you know, what we built from that top down approach, like we've gone through here to do that tactically. So I think that's a good point, Mike, that like they don't actually have to make that call. If they want to, they can. And we have a lot of advisors that are doing that themselves, and that's fine. But there's probably a majority, I hear from them the most, but there's the other 80% of our subscribers on financial technology software, and probably a higher percentage of the advisors out there that aren't doing that, that need a system, that need or fund or whatever to help them kind of make those kind of calls if they don't want to kind of manage that themselves or don't have the tools or the emotional behavioral finance. Because I'm as portfolio manager the last couple of years, man, it's hard. Like you see an amazing earnings report from a company come out and it's down 15%. And you're like, what just happened? Everything, all the trends, all the charts, everything, all the data was there except for one management statement at the end of the outlook wasn't maybe as good as they wanted it to be. So it's a hard market. Even when you think you have everything figured out, it humbles you really quick. So you have to let the system and the data kind of point you in that direction and follow it. And that's kind of what the sectors is showing us here. This is just a snapshot of North America. The differences between Canada and the US that we manage, because we are talking about a divergence, right? The US is still really strong in certain areas, especially in the IT sector over the last month. Energy has been very strong over the last basically all year, except for the last couple of weeks. But that still is very strong within our system on both sides. Now, Canada is a much larger weighting towards that. And so you see that up, you know, 25% over the last 3 months, right? And that's where we've been talking about all year for advisors, and also keeping them out of maybe underperforming sectors like healthcare in Canada isn't that big. Communication services is a big sector. And that's where we've been maybe diverting that money away. And probably a couple differences is we see utilities very strong in the US side. And what does that really mean? Well, that's data infrastructure these days. It's not your classic utility company.
It's not the old utilities. Exactly.
And the same thing like communication services. Yeah. You actually see more of those kind of companies that are actually tied to the data infrastructure boom that's going on. And that's not going away, right? So even if we talk about, hey, you should be out of US, we're not saying to be out of those kind of names. We might say, hey, you want to be out of maybe consumer staples, even discretionary. You usually don't see them down here at the bottom together in the US. So that's pretty interesting. Or again, real estate or other things affected by interest rates and potential rising. What's being affected by rising oil prices? Well, every sector, but it affects certain sectors like transportation and things like that more. And so they're already adapting to that outlook, going forward. And then obviously the industrials is really strong in. I would say, I know it's not as highly ranked in Canada. There's just not as many names, but the ones that are there are still pretty strong from an aerospace and defense, from a manufacturing standpoint. The smaller cap companies in the US are very strong for manufacturing because that's really their market, right? They don't actually, by getting less competition, they are still doing very well. So this is kind of one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is we put the 50 most liquid names of each sector kind of in one report together and can really see that movement now across the board. So this was done as of April 13th, if you're listening in the podcast later in the future, so things will obviously change. But I just want to kind of focus on the top and the bottom of this report for a second. This isn't a new story, but this has been something we've been talking about and other people have been talking about since probably quarter four at the latest last year of 2025, where we saw the divergence of obviously, semiconductors have been on a heater over the last couple of years, but we started to see computer software turn. So I wanted to show you another chart that kind of goes into that over time. And this only goes up till February, but the trend has continued. This is one that I talked about that has a lot of detail. So if you're listening to the podcast, I'll try to do the best to explain this. There's a lot of text on here. I know it's hard to see. But really what this chart looks at is, when was ChatGPT launched in the end of 2022? It kind of looks at what semiconductors have done over time, as well as computer software. And I was very surprised to see how strong computer software did, because at the very beginning, this was a boom for them, right? Hey, we can complement, we can add it on, and it's not going to replace it. That wasn't the story at the beginning, right? And then NVIDIA really went on a run, 2023, 2024. People understood the general market. There's certain people that always understood this, the reality of what that GPU super cycle really meant. And then software really took off, really from 2024. It outperformed semiconductors because people were very hopeful that software could monetize this, right? This software as a service could really, gain so much more ability and opportunity that way. And so we saw that rise and that outperformance relative to, the semiconductor kind of space over that time period. And then we saw tariffs. We saw, a lot of things fluctuate again in March of April of 2025. And this purple line down here is one that I snuck in here, which is the data infrastructure, right? It's kind of the real estate side of it, but the digital and data center infrastructure has underperformed since the beginning, but has really come on strong. And one of my favorite topics to talk about. And again, this isn't a new story today because we already kind of know how it's been playing out, but it's going to continue playing out from my point of view. Again, I'm not always right, but that's what the data is showing us, that money flow is still going into this. And you've seen just outrageous numbers, I would say, come out from all the Mag 7, all these top companies where they're spending not a billion or 2 billion, hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars, like just numbers you haven't heard of on these spaces, on these sectors. So again, it's just following the money. It's the same thing we do with relative strength analysis. But from a charting standpoint, you can see that divergence here. The software was actually outperforming 1 year ago versus semiconductors. And now you wouldn't even be able to sell somebody a pen in that space. Like it's gargantuan, that difference, as everybody understood that traditional SaaS was, software as a service has been very challenged and disrupted by obviously these autonomous AI tools. And I have a couple slides that can show that what's hacked for a couple of stocks too, if you want. But I wanted to pause here because I know you guys probably have some thoughts around this, or wanted to maybe comment a little bit on this further.
Yeah, I think you're, the
interesting
the story that certainly has been something that I have been trying to highlight via the price movement, is the fact that you have an S-curve in technology, right? Yep. So you have this AI and the adoption follows an S-curve, because you can't. But that S curve then meets squarely the J curve of resource development, power infrastructure, energy grid constraints, and the bottlenecks that you've highlighted on the slide. And so that clash has been occurring, as we pointed out, for the last sort of 6 months. And so that is that's the reality of constraint. There, to me, in the AI world, there's two constraints that constrain the S-curve adoption on the tech side. One is the physical physics and atoms and data centers and grid that's required to support it. That's one. The second is the human behavior, right? You have to go through all these companies with policies and procedures now for AI use and implementation. You have to get new humans that can use them and are trained to use them, as well as the infrastructure to supervise them. And so you have these two J curves that are colliding with this AI S curve. And what you're seeing in price on the physics side, the build out side, is what you're showing in this chart. Outperformance by that area. And it looks like it's sustained, and it's sustained by those hundreds of billions of dollars in spend that you mentioned. That's the story that we're creating, I will highlight, that follows this price. The bottom line make sure you pay attention to the price. This is where actual assets are transacting. These are the footprints in the sand of the very large institutional investors that are moving money around, and you get to observe that.
And I like that. I mean, this action on this chart shows that the market clearly doesn't see the activity in the infrastructure subsiding anytime soon.
Yeah.
Even with this conflict, the conflict itself might be disruptive to liquidity, but it's not disruptive to the long-term technical trend that we're seeing in that purple line.
Yeah. And, you know, everybody's like, hey, this is a great chart, but like, isn't that after the fact? Well, I kind of go back to this again saying, no, like since then, semiconductors up another 17% over the last month, while software is down another 5%. And again, look back in the 3-year trends, like this isn't even what I just showed in the chart, isn't even up to date with all that information, right? Like this trend has continued. And I just want to give two quick examples of what that actually looks like from an individual standpoint. We looked at it from a sector standpoint, we looked at a comparison standpoint. Well, here's Salesforce. Again, one of the best CRMs in the world, but they're being challenged the most especially from the market standpoint of their value. So since the green overlay on here, this is for everybody listening, this is a point and figure chart. Every X in here, it represents the upward movement, positive movement, and every O represents negative movement down. It's on a 2% scale, which means every X or O is a 2% move. Now, we're not going to get into the charts too much, but I just want to highlight the bigger picture. This green is when it's been favorable to other investments in the S&P 100 index universe. And then when it's red, it means it's basically in the bottom half. It's in the unfavored zone, the bottom 50% of that report, where we wouldn't look to own it at all. And so when it hit kind of a sell recommendation, sell trigger within that universe, that was around, 320, 325, and it's down 46% since that period in February, right? So we just talked about when that divergence happened. That was actually before on that comparison chart, but this individual sell for this company happened here, and it's still that downside risk protection, right? So it's not too late. It's not too late to still make those kind of calls, because sometimes these continue for long periods of time. You said it's not a day trading system. We're looking at the longer period of time. And this chart, I couldn't even get all on the screen because of the upside potential. But this is one of the funds we actually own still currently. So disclaimer there. In some of our funds at SI Wealth Management, Sienna's a telecommunication services company, but it's a networking company, right? So it's connecting all these data centers. It's connecting all these players that we're talking about. So it's not one of those that you would think of right away when you think about semiconductors or computer hardware, but we identified it in one of our funds and bought it on September 10th, around $128. And now it's trading at $470.67. And every fund manager has some of these stories, but I kind of point this out to kind of show, hey, this September was where's September on here, right? Right at this inflection point where software was the exact same point of performance since ChatGPT launched than the other one. So that's, just following the system, following the money, there was some movement into there as they both went up, and then it kind of diverged since that point. So that's why I picked that chart and that point. To kind of show that in reality of action of how the system can help you find those names and keep you in them to see that upside potential a lot more than just the index itself that you might be following, even though that would still be a great sector play on its own.
That's valuable.
Yeah.
I mean, especially when you have inflection points like SaaSpocalypse.
Ha.
Yeah.
and
you can only see
the SaaSpocalypse
looking back, but
I think I think this largely pricing, repricing the multiple. It's not to say that these companies are all going bankrupt. I think that's the SaaS overreach. But it is to say that in an AI world, that the forward growth multiples might not be as robust. Thus, the forward multiple needs to probably contract. And the market sorts that out. But until the market figures that out, until the market decides that that is actually a thing, if you try to predict that before price action moves, you can be sitting a long time doing nothing for the market, for you waiting for the market to realize what you've realized. And sometimes it never happens. So it's often much nicer to wait for confirmation via price, as Paul points out here, and then start to make allocations in a graduated way to build up positioning.
So I just have a couple more slides. If you want, I can talk about kind of what do things look like right now with the S&P 100? Like, what are some of these mega cap names? How are we positioned? And it just kind of continues that trend we just talked about, right? What are basically these top five names, or five out of the top six names right now, are all in that semiconductor space. And it's definitely went on a short-term run here. This will probably pull back as it usually does in the near term. But still, that longer-term trend that we're talking about isn't necessarily going away. So even though we don't like U.S. equity from a broad-based standpoint as much as Canada and the international on the SI Wealth side of things, look at these opportunities still that are tracking this way. And I'm sure by the time this podcast comes out, things are going to be widely changing, because every day, you know, conflict is changing the way the markets are reacting. But, you know, at least that longer term trend that we talked about since September last year continues, right? And it's going to go through its ups and downs. We're going to have, definitely going to have some pullbacks in this space, because they can't continue in this trajectory necessarily all the way up. But that longer term pairs trade, if you want, is continuing until the price action tells us otherwise. So that's how it's being positioned. Energy is still strong, but that we are seeing these energy companies move off in the near term. I would expect that to come back if something doesn't happen, or, right now it's just at a current ceasefire. Well, it's not a peace treaty yet, right? And maybe I'll just skip ahead to that real quick. Just, I don't want to get too political or ongoing, but this is still the fact of all the ships in, there's still this underlying issue of build up and that's, you can say the blockade's working, all that kind of stuff, but there's still some underlying issues here that are really affecting chemicals, obviously oil and gas, and a number of other industries related to that, through that, and different countries more too, right? There's, Japan, India, China, are very dependent on oil and gas from this market. There's other countries that have built up reserves, like Japan, 250 days that they can, not really worry about this right now, but they're also firing up their coal plants. They're also taking action to get around this issue. So there's still hundreds of ships stuck in until this issue is resolved. And that could be today, tomorrow, who knows? I'm not putting any predictions on that. There's still this underlying issue that's going to have to get resolved before we really see some changes in the ranking. So I don't make predictions. That's the great part about my job, is I just follow the money flow. And right now it's saying, hey, we're flowing back into some of the semiconductors, that overall trend that we're seeing. But there is certain companies that we would take higher bets on than others, and we want to keep an eye out for that. And then what I like about this system is it's also it's also identifying some other sectors you might not think about. Like, banking has actually stayed up really strong in financials
that's
longer than I would have actually expected in the US, right? So it's holding on. This isn't a 2008 financial crisis. Like, they're doing very well. And pharmaceuticals and drug companies were also one that we identified. Manufacturing is held on in certain segments of the industry. Again, some are more impacted internationally by it, but others are thriving, especially more in the mid-small cap case, I would say. So that's the amazing part about this market is, I think relative strength is a unique opportunity to help find where those are, to best position it. You don't actually see as much metals and mining on here. I'm going to move over to the TSX 60, unless you want to make your comments first,
Mike. Yeah, before you go, a couple of things on this chart. There's the ranking that you're seeing.
Sure.
but it's also the monthly change column. And are they moving up in rankings versus moving down in rankings? Yeah. And so you can see the ebb and flow under the surface. Banking is a good one. Like you look at these large banking companies, Citigroup, New York, and they've come out with earnings that they're just beating across the board. By the way,
Morgan Stanley today.
They were in the top relative strength before they beat today or in the last week as they've been reporting. So, look at what's going up and going down because you probably, as you pointed out, oil had a big spike. You're going to see some of those up in the top relative strength, but they're going to kind of be maybe trickling down a little bit as we work through this. So you want to be aware of where things are ranking, but you also want to be aware of where they have been ranking relatively. And are they moving up? Are they moving down? That'll give you some extra indications, as to where you might want to position yourself. You can buy the rips or you can buy the dips, right? So you want to be in strong sectors and maybe buy those pullbacks. But some people like to buy the rip too. Both are good. Not making any judgment there. Lastly, before we go, you mentioned something at the beginning, which was politics. Mm-hmm. Please, please, please keep your politics out of your investing.
Yep.
If you color your investing via your politics, that's not an optimal strategy. It may work at times. It's not going to work at others. There's no real data that supports having a political bent on your investing. Again, relative strength is telling you where the price and the strength is moving and the action is going. And use that and keep the politics out of your investing. Great to talk at parties and whatnot.
Yeah.
But from an investing perspective, ignore the politics. Pay attention to your system and your process.
Well, that's one of the great things about SIA charts is that it just completely ignores all that.
Yep.
You don't even have to, you don't have to watch any of that.
Yep.
Absolutely. And it's hard.
You don't have to consider it.
We all have our opinions and predictions
all the time.
And you might not agree with everything, but it doesn't matter. And I think this chart looks a lot different than the US side. So that's why I wanted to bring it up. Again, you could come in with the political angle and say, hey, I don't believe in energy and pipelines and all this stuff. It doesn't matter. Follow the money, follow the system. And we talked about, you wanting a really good example of, the system identifying gold and keeping you in it. And Kinross is our probably our success story there, where and some other names, but that one rock and rolled for 2 years in the system. And historically, it's been much more volatile. Like we've seen it move up and down with the gold kind of spikes up and down. This has been the longest gold rally I've seen in my lifetime, it seems like, where the SI chart system historically hasn't been as great identifying it, but it was amazing here. And the longevity of those, that kind of rotation kept in over that time period. And now we're seeing the same thing with the energy. Sorry, not the same thing. We're seeing that rotation in energy on the Canadian side. And it's a lot different than we saw in the US, where the currency is coming into play, right? The other aspects are coming into play with some longer term value. So most of our positioning is not actually US energy. It's international, like I talked about, maybe South America. It's Canadian energy, right? So even when we talk about a sector, it's where's that sector, right? That's a hard question to be in. How do I actually want to be positioned? If you're just buying an energy ETF, you could be missing out even on opportunities within that of how you want to best be positioned. So this Canada obviously doesn't have the same semiconductor space and opportunities as the US. You'd want to look to the US for that, most likely. You'd want to actually look for Canada for energy, as well as, within Canada, it's done very well in a number of other areas too that we can get into. But I think here is just a good example of what's working now. You still see banking strong, right? You see banking and financial strong on both sides of the coin in North America and internationally for the most part too. But I think you really see the chemicals, the minings, the energy as an opportunity here with that strong financial and basis. And that's most of what the TSX Composite is made up of. It's over 50%, right? Just those three sectors alone. So if that's what's rocking and rolling, it's hard to beat the benchmark when those kind of things are doing it. If you're an active or passive advisor out there or portfolio manager, it doesn't matter. But if you can position yourself that way and take advantage of those opportunities here going forward, these, again, usually aren't short-term kind of moves. They are telling us something longer-term if that's happening. And even if oil comes down a little bit, it's still trading in the 90 to 100 range most of the time. It's still very volatile, but that's still very profitable for really all Canadian energy companies.
Yeah. Do you think most advisors...
Oh, go ahead, Priyo.
Do you think most advisors are actually positioned to benefit from that, or are they still sort of stuck in 2025 in the U.S. overweight?
Yeah, so I have a good story to tell you guys. So I worked with an advisor group recently here in Calgary, and we're in Calgary, the energy capital of Canada, right? So I was very, they'd done very well with the Cytrat system because they were overweighted into metals and mining, took advantage of the gold run, the system identified and kept them in it. So again, part of our success story is our advisors' stories that are using us, and you know, their clients are very happy, right, for their performance. But we were talking to them, I think, in February or March when did the Iran conflict happen? Right at the end of February. So it was early March, right, yeah. And they had no exposure to energy. So this is a Calgary advisor base that had zero exposure to energy. So I talked quite a bit to them, and I said, you know, this is when crude was already up about 50% on the year. It's gone up more since then. I was like, hey, you're taking a stance, whether you think about it or not, by basically zero exposure to this, or maybe they had a very small exposure. I shouldn't say zero, but I talked to him about, hey, you don't have to be right or wrong here, but you kind of almost want to buy energy as a hedge, right? Like the system is telling you this, and their personal behavioral kind of issues, and maybe their clients as well, were getting in the way of them following the system. And so that's why we had the call and we kind of talked it through and just saying like, hey, you don't have to be right or wrong here. That's not the goal of this conversation. I'm not here to influence you one way or the other, but don't like fight against the market. Align yourself with the market. Please don't fight against the market. Align, right? If everything is telling you to be in energy, take some exposure there. And if it falls right off, you really were just buying insurance, right? And so you can kind of hedge that way. If you don't believe in semiconductors going forward, even after this call, that's okay. But you might not want to make a call one way or the other, right? Like the market, the market cap of all the safe indexes out there have huge exposures to energy and to semiconductors in the US. So by not participating in some of these, you're actually betting against it, whether you think about that or not. So that's how we kind of worked through that real life scenario of like, hey, they didn't want to buy into energy, or it wasn't that they didn't want to buy in energy. They thought it was too late, right? And I was like, hey, I don't know when this conflict's going to end, and I'm never going to make that prediction. But you know, use this as kind of an insurance in case the war drags on longer than they think. And I think after that conversation, guess what they did? I think they followed through on some of that. And it's been 6 weeks or 5 weeks since that time period where that kind of call would have benefited them. And hopefully will continue to benefit them going forward. Even if it reverses, they were able to kind of buy that insurance policy or that's cash or something else in a different sector combination. Doesn't matter. It's again, like Mike and you guys have said, you know, don't just follow the price action. That's the simplest way to kind of look at this. And every year we do this podcast, it's kind of the same story. And in a way that's just different scenarios and different politics and scenarios and events and sector rotations, but it's the same kind of thing. If you follow the price action of the market, more often than not, that trend is going to help you in the long run.
These biases that we have as in, you know, as human beings, of course, not just as investors, but when you, I think the quote that applies best here is, you know, those who know it best love it the least.
Mr. Cox, right? Mr. Don Cox.
Yeah. And, that's really the case here, right? I mean, if you're talking about, especially about a Calgary advisor group, they're right in the thick of it, and yeah, they've got this blind spot, right? Because it's affected their lives.
Yeah.
Right? It's affected their lifetimes as investors to be right so close to the thing and to know it best. But
and great to point. To your point, Paul, on, you know, the idea of do Canadian investors have more exposure, too much exposure to the US side versus the Canadian side, and so on. One is that there's always a pretty significant home country bias in any country you go to. So probably they have a fair bit of Canada already. But if you look globally and say, well, how much know, could we get a sense of how much the world is overweight the US? Well, we can't. If we look at global market cap, 65% of global market cap right now, give or take a little bit, is US equities. So if you're a global asset manager in Japan or France or Portugal or South Africa, and you are buying global market cap weighted stocks in your portfolio, 65% of them are US equities. I don't know, 20 or 15% or seven stocks. So is the world overweight from a market cap perspective historically? Yeah, vastly. That's usually, it's been 30, 35, 40% generally. And because we've had such persistent outperformance for a decade and a half, you have market cap weightings in US equities vis-a-vis global equities that is very, very high. Now, does that continue where it is? Does it go down? Does it regress? Does it go to 80%? We don't know. We'll follow price. Right? Because it can go higher. Nothing says it can't go to be more. At the moment, though, when we follow price, it says, no, actually, these other the other 35% is actually outperforming the 65%. So you may want to pay attention to that. So from a just general perspective, are US equities overweight? Historically speaking, from their average, yeah, globally, they are. And so what that means is pretty much every country has a lot of US exposure. And everybody's overweight,
yeah,
vis-a-vis the historical average. That, again, but they were overweight at 55% U.S. equities in that, and it went up another 10%. So, you know, pick your poison, which way you want to track that and what bet you want to take. But you should have a system underlying it. And another thing you touched on, Paul, which I think is absolutely critical, probably the quintessential point, which is the end investor's bias. And how do we work around those biases with that end investor in the conversation you had with them, right? And that is a really, really tricky situation because you want to get the investor to these alternative asset classes, whether they're diversifiers, whether they're adding certain sectors, you want to get them there. But you have to respect what their behavioral limitations are, what their tracking error issues might be vis-a-vis what is their actual underlying index that they're tracking and the tracking error to that index. And then the actual transactions on a day-to-day basis can be frustrating because there's lots of times where something starts to outperform and then it doesn't. And then you have to bring the position up and you bring it down and you have a small loss or maybe you have a break even or you have a slightly bigger loss. Those in the short term, those transactions can be challenging because everyone wants to just buy it and be right for the next 6 months or 12 months. And that's just not the way it works. Why I bring that up is because that often allows for a better client experience when you do some cloaking. And we call it cloaking. And cloaking is simply to say, you know, well, why not buy some of the SAA products? Right? They're actually doing that under the surface for you automatically every day, Groundhog Day, rebalancing, looking at these things. And the client doesn't need to see the messy kitchen. They just get to eat the delicious steak. Don't get them in the kitchen. Let them have the steak. Get away from the nonsense. Return stacking does that as well. You know, we've got very active portfolios. They're stacked on top of the beta and they are doing those day-to-day swings. They're looking at the market every day, rebalancing the positions every day and taking that noise out and just allowing the investor to see the actual end result. And it sort of short circuits a lot of some of the challenges that investors may have with the short term transactions. And sometimes, you know, having 10 transactions, you do relative strength, you know, 3 are going to be losers, 4 are going to be kind of in the middle and 3 are going to be really big winners. And those 3 winners are the ones you want to get because they're going to pay for all those other 7 that, you know, were kind of in the middle somewhere.
Yep.
So you need those numbers. So a way to do that is to look for managers and funds that are active tactically to complement your portfolio so that you don't have to do that part, but you get that increased excess return vis-a-vis the risk you're taking built into your portfolio, that diversifying aspect into your portfolio, and which in the end creates better client outcomes. Either allows them to take more money out in retirement, allows them to have a longer certainty around retirement, or gives them more money at the end when they're dead. Those are the things that it does by adding these types of risk-reducing strategies and sort of price-aware strategies.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Paul, if you If you set aside the near term noise and think about where capital is going, where capital is going to want to be over the next 12 to 18 months, what's the thesis you keep coming back to?
So you're asking me to make a prediction over the next 12 to 18 months? No.
Well, maybe not. No, not so much that, but
no,
what signals are you getting that are, what are the durable signals that you're getting right now? I think that's something that,
for sure,
that, you know, so advisors really want to, I mean, we kind of started off with that. And then one of those durable signals is the infrastructure.
Yeah.
You know, the AI related infrastructure, the data centers. Right. For that's sure. One of the durable sort of items. But what are some of the other durable items that you're seeing?
For sure. So I think a couple, good chance to kind of recap what we talked about today too, right? Like we've seen that trend of international Canada versus US. There's opportunities there. Like Mike pointed out, most people are overweight US. This is an opportunity, taking away what you've maybe done over the last 10 years to kind of say, hey, we actually do want to have a little bit more home bias here. We do have, and I actually don't think it's so much in Canada. I think it's internationally, right? So most people have maybe a 10% sleeve in international. We're talking ex North America when I talk about international here, just for listeners. So that's an opportunity to grow. And that's something we're looking very closely on, potentially launching, you know, different strategies around that to help advisors with that opportunity. So that's been most of my conversations over the last year. It's not about building better Canadian strategies. Most advisors are actually pretty good at that. And the US has been the focus, but it's been international. I think still watching cash. Like I said, cash is still our number three ranked asset class right at this time of recording over US equity, right? Like that's telling us something. We got to watch that, still pay attention to that from a tactical standpoint. But I think we're seeing more real assets over financial assets, right? We've seen the private markets and, you know, those kind of things, gold and silver and platinum and copper and the industrial metals are still going to be a core theme here going forward from our standpoint. Same thing with energy, you know, domestic production over global supply chains is going to be even more important. You see that. I think that's a trend that's been happening in the US for a while. Canada's fighting that a little bit still, but, and there's still defensive and infrastructure opportunities along with the electrical data AI infrastructure opportunities, right? So I don't think any of those trends are changing anytime soon. If they do change in the short term, the longer term trend is still probably going to be there from now performance, at least compared to the other side of that coin. The other kind of things that could unhinge this are obviously the conflict in the Middle East, but also the, you know, the trade negotiations with Canada, Mexico, and US later this year, I think in quarter three, that could change the dynamics between Canada and the US and even internationally too, because when we talk about the international markets, you throw Canada in with the 65% of the weighting in the US, you're talking about almost 70% of the world market. It's not quite that much, but Canada's not that big, but it's still, yeah, that could change the outlook for Canada going forward or just make it more interesting, something to follow. Again, very political, but at the same point, let's follow the money and see where that goes. So if you don't have a system in place for quarter two and quarter three of this year, you're going to need it. Like it's not going to be an easy market. I think Mike talked about the choppiness of the sectors. I think we're going to see a little bit more of that. I don't think we're going to see these long-term trends as in a couple of them will continue, but a couple of these will fail and they're going to change to something else. And I think the trade negotiations could be that wrench that we just, nobody can predict what's going to happen there or how long that will take. But, you know, there could be opportunities to raise cash later this year if that happens or the markets change in those ways. So I think the winners of the next cycle are going to look very different than the winners of the last one. And that's something for people to be excited about, but also cautious about if you don't have a way to change over time. So keep that in mind when you're picking funds or picking strategies here going forward, because the market doesn't always ring the bell at the top or the bottom, right? And we have to, like I said, align yourself with the market by capturing the trends and hopefully create a winning strategy. So that's what we try to do. And this is what I know Mike and their team try to do as well. So that's kind of where I see the next year, 18 months going forward is definitely some uncertainty, but there's going to be some of those same trends that will continue through. Energy to me is the biggest wild card of where that's going to go, at least in the short term and the long term. We'll see that probably be impacted the most over the next couple months.
Great stuff.
Yeah. And what, and 12 months from now, Paul, what's the biggest surprise?
I think most people, this isn't like a hot take or anything, but a year from now, like AI impacting all industries, like certain industries first, more so than others. And I'm not the AI expert. I wish I was. but I think you're going to see it dramatically change even players that look safe. That, and you're also going to see, I think, some companies that are maybe like a 5-person company become like a $1 billion valuation. Like, you're going to see some of these things come up faster than ever before that are just positioned in an area to take advantage of it. So you're just going to see disruption in different ways. I don't think this is a, this isn't a 12 month, like this can happen every 6 months, right? You're already seeing that in some of the areas, companies that I love that you think are well positioned. And then all of a sudden, I don't know, Anthropic or OpenAI or somebody's going to come out with something that just wrecks them, right? So I think disruption is going to be a key theme over the next 12 months. And like I said, that's not necessarily a hot take, but it's something that you kind of have to keep your ears to the ground. And that's why you just follow the market. And if you don't necessarily make predictions around that, because it's going to come pretty fast and furious. So if you're not spending the time doing that personally or at your company, it's a very worthwhile investment, because the disruption aspect is going to definitely impact some industries a lot more. And I look at healthcare and the legal aspects first, but we're in the financial markets. Do you think it's not coming for us as well, right? Like it's going to, I think, impact it a lot more than most people think, but not necessarily in Canada, because of the foundations that we have in our banking and our financial system. It's going to take a little bit longer to maybe impact that, but it might impact around the edges. And then at some point, it's going to be very disruptive to the main core businesses. So we'll see. We'll see when that happens. Who knows? But yeah, disruption is probably the key in areas that were maybe safe before or legacy businesses.
It's going to be busy. when people say that this is the AI opportunity and it's huge and all those things, what they're also saying at the same time is that it's going to disintermediate a lot of businesses. So in order to create a massive business, you're going to probably disintermediate some other businesses in doing that.
Yeah.
You know, there's the story of the one guy with the GLP-1 drugs who's got $400 million in revenue overnight, setting up all of it himself. He was very technically oriented and had expertise in that area. So we shouldn't underestimate his actual skills. But here he is with a multi-million-dollar business. You've got, Claude, C-A-L-W-D, that also, became a billion-dollar entity overnight virtually.
Yeah.
What that does though, you also saw, billions of market cap erased from SaaS at the same time. And that's the disintermediation. And so you've got, I think Paul's like bang on. Think about, stocks are discounting mechanisms. All assets are discounting mechanisms for future price of some kind, commodities, bonds, stocks. They're trying to discount future price in a time where we have massive disruption, right? So massive disruption that has never occurred before. And so that's the scenario we sit in. As these asset classes are trying to look into the future, discount those future cash flows back to some value, all the while a massive disruption with this new thing called AI is occurring, and all of the underlying things that need to be that are required to make that happen that we've talked about. So, it's going to be interesting, and it's going to be, I think, an opportunity for those who have the process. And also the actual ability, and I mean ability both from a process and a good ability there, but the actual ability at a portfolio level. So portfolio agility and mandate flexibility are two things that often managers don't have. If you're managing an S&P 500 ETF, there's no mandate flexibility and there's no portfolio agility. You have what you have. If you're a large pension that has, $100 billion in assets under management, you don't have a lot of portfolio agility, and the board has the mandate. So the mandate's, somewhat limited in its flexibility. Contrast that with an individual investor looking after their own assets. Their portfolio agility and mandate flexibility is entirely theirs to choose, theirs to decide. And that's where the opportunity for outperformance comes, in that individual investor or that smaller portfolio where they actually do have the ability to have flexibility on the mandate side, and also can execute some agility in the portfolio side, you have the opportunity to take advantage of some pretty interesting changes in leadership rather than, you know, trying to keep up with the S&P that's dominated by seven stocks, which is a harder proposition in that perspective. So, you know, if you're out there, think through that, think about how much of the portfolio falls into that construct and how much you can build in and add diversifiers, that like Paul's product, things that like managed futures that can be either long or short, and, think about how you want to deploy those through the portfolio.
Paul, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight. Where can people find you?
Yeah, find us at siawealth.com. And if you're an advisor looking for a technology solution, if this connected with you, we also have sicharts.com that I used to be the president of that helps advisors navigate the markets, right? Through that uncertainty. But if you're looking for funds and strategies or further partnership, custom indexing and those kind of deeper level conversations too, we're really trying to partner with advisors to a different level so that we can automate that, take that away, not take that away, but make their business more efficient, from that custom aspect of what they're trying to accomplish for their clients too. So they get that tactical and custom aspect as part of their business. So that's kind of the direction that we're trying to go with advisors so that they have a better experience and their clients and their firm have a better experience as well. So that's kind of where we're going. So yeah, reach out. Thanks so much for inviting me on again. Hopefully we can do it again in the future.
Always amazing, Paul. Great. I mean, I think what you're offering, just to cap it off, is you're offering advisors an edge. I mean, that they might not already have. You know, that's a very big deal, especially in the competitive marketplace that we're in now.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Paul.